funny, there are two very competing ideas that I kind of want to talk about, and they may not actually compete. One of them is change. Seems right for the times. And the other is the utter unknowability of the other person. And I should add to that, the other element is the utter unknowability of your own self. Talk about that first. It is really hard to understand how different we all are from one another. We share certain sensibilities. We have bodies. We appear in this time and space. We have hopes, ambitions, drives, fears, feelings that are often way beyond our comprehension and ability to handle. And we have our own configuration of that, and then we have to deal with somebody else's configuration of that. And they don't fit very well. Sometimes, however, we make assumptions that we have found a fit. We have found something that aligns us and brings us together and makes us friends, lovers, partners, couples. And it's usually an alignment that is so satisfying in the moment that one imagines it will endure forever. And in some cases it does. But in a lot of cases it's under stress, and there's a lot of strain in relationship. There's a lot of strain in people's assumptions about one another and finding that they change and they differ, and then discovering that you don't really know your own assumptions about yourself. You think one thing, and then signals come to show you that you're not who you think you are, or that you're not what you think you are, and that's very disconcerting. And so we live a life trying to find some harmony, balance, stability in our individual selves, in our own self, that can function reliably in a world that is not always reliable in its form and in its offerings. And then we try to align with people, partner, tribe, society, that shares enough of our normative nature that we figure we can function within it. And most of us in our culture particularly have been lucky on that regard. We have found in this experimental world of a democracy that we have been living in for 240 some years that we have found enough similarity and enough simplicity in our dealings with the world that we function. And all of that is wonderful when it works. And all of that is not as wonderful when it doesn't work. And so we have to figure out, how do we make it work? If it's starting to be less than easy, if it's starting to be stressful or conflicted. Which brings me to a dialogue Blanche and I had last week with our couples therapist. And I think most of you know Blanche and I do go to a couples therapist. We've been going ever since we struggled over how to get rid of, or whether we should get rid of, the New York house. So it's been a while. We were really at odds with how do we handle this. We didn't find that we could share a dialogue that made it easy to get past our emotions and our concerns and our fears and our hopes and all of those different things. And so we found a therapist who we could talk to, and it was really helpful, because she took us outside of our own perspective and gave us a third perspective, and often challenged how we looked at the situation. And she just helped us find our common ground which allowed us in the end to let go of something that was very important to both of us for different reasons, but very important. And letting go was really hard, one of the hardest things that we've ever done in this lifetime. So learning to let go and having somebody mirror you in a way, or show you who you are and show you what your real thoughts are as opposed to your assumed thoughts, and what you care about and what you don't care about, and what's important and what's not important, was really valuable to us. We continue to see her every week on Skype, really. And it's kind of fascinating. It's fascinating because Blanche and I don't have a lot of issues. You know, some couples have big issues and they're always on the verge of some kind of tragic choice with their relationships. We don't have that. We have a relatively smooth relationship with certain areas that are just difficult for us. It's not fair to have Blanche not sit here with me to talk about this because she has a different sensibility. My biggest issue with Blanche is that we're never on the same page in terms of time. And we find it very difficult to get somewhere in time. And I won't go into all the dynamics of that, but it's enough of a distress that it causes an ongoing kind of tension, a kind of an absurd tension. But it really allows us a dialogue that we share with our therapist, and then it leads into other things, other areas of our own, which you might call blindness to who we are. We get to see things that we certainly can't share or talk about with each other because we don't see them. We don't know them. And it's really difficult. So what we do is we talk with a third party. We have an objective, kind of objective viewpoint from the outside. And that objective viewpoint allows us to look at the other from a perspective that challenges our assumptions and makes us realize that we don't really know who we are. And therefore, what we need to do is find an avenue of rapprochement that allows us to maintain the difficulty of balance and harmony in relationship every day. And we sit and we do this once a week with this therapist, and it really works. It really allows for a dialogue that does not arise normally, because most of the time, preoccupation, busyness, life is okay, nothing's problematic, everything's going along. But we always have these little tiny underlying tensions or things that disturb us that are allowed to come up with this third party in sitting there clarifying for us how we misperceive one another. It's really valuable. It's really valuable in the larger dialogue of how to live with another person. How does one bring that into a societal framework? I don't have an answer for that. I don't. But what it leads me to, and the reason we went to this woman in the first place, was because we were dealing with change. And this woman, who I loved just deeply, she teaches in a prison. She teaches women. She works with women in a prison. And she sees and clarifies for me exactly what we're talking about here, how people do not talk to each other. They talk around each other. They talk through each other. They talk based on their misperceptions and perceptions, and they don't get to the point. They don't get to clarity usually. And so she's trying to understand, how do I help these people get there? And she came up with a title that I thought was brilliant. Should be a book, and maybe if she will ever do it, it would be a book. It's called It's an Inside Job. Perfect line for, I guess, people in prison, because you're locked inside. And also the idea that so many crimes are inside jobs. But the truth is, the inside job that all of us need to address is what is within. What is within us that can be altered, looked at, examined, considered, that might actually allow us to begin to see, one, who we are, and two, who someone else is. And that out of that alignment of seeing ourself and seeing then someone else, we might discover commonalities that actually allow us to come together. And it may be the only answer. It's not going to be worked out outside you, because outside you, unless you have a third party who's willing to dialogue with you, but that third party really is trying to help you go inside to see what needs to be looked at that you're not seeing. That third party is very valuable. But we have a process here that we call sitting still or meditation. Sitting still, meditation, is a way of letting go of the outer form and going to the inner. And another way of looking at it, which I think is really important, is going from the world of changeability and change and transformation into what the deepest of the practitioners of meditation and meditative teaching call the unchangeable. That there is a place called the unchangeable. And out of the unchangeable arises unbelievable transformative change, which causes all sorts of distress and disturbance and complications in life. And it's a really interesting dynamic, because most of us claim, or not most of us, many people claim that they don't like change. But I think the truth is, as best as I can understand it, we like change that moves toward things getting better. And we don't like change that moves toward things getting worse. So we have a real investment in a certain kind of change, which makes the world more appearing, it appears the world is on our side. And when changes occur that we don't like, the world is against us. And that is a perception that can differ from person to person. Because there are people for whom a certain kind of change makes them think, oh, this is good. And the exact same change perceived by other people is, oh, this is terrible. It doesn't work for us. And that unbelievable kind of separation in ways of viewing the same thing causes all of the drama that we know in this lifetime. For me, this change is terrific. For me, this change is the worst thing ever. Now what? Now what? How do we create society? How do we create a culture where one person's change is wonderful and the same change for someone else is just terrible? And the only thing I can present as an alternative would be a third party, a therapist for the culture. I have no idea who that is or where that would be or how you would find it. I don't imagine it kind of exists. Perhaps a great statesman or a great leader, a Winston Churchill, a Franklin Roosevelt, those are my perceptions of great people, a Mahatma Gandhi, they can change the cultural dialogue a little bit. They can give you another perspective and help bring about a revolution that is full of peace and full of transformative power without causing real damage and harm to others. That's rare. And certainly, right now, I don't see anybody assuming that role in the larger culture. So where can we go? Where can one go? Well, to the inside job. The inside job is in you. It's in you. And how do you get there? Well, you know, this is something I talk about week after week after week after week. But it involves stillness, sitting still, and diving beyond all of the stuff that does not like sitting still. And of course, for most people, the act of sitting still is a revolutionary idea, and it is horrifying. Sitting still brings up all your stuff. It brings up everything. It brings up your emotions, your thoughts, your ideas, all the stuff that's been instilled in you since you were however old, the stuff that you believe and hold on to for deaths, until death do you part. All of these issues that are in you are playing on the surface, and as soon as I say sit still, your stillness is enraged with stuff. And it's the last place you want to go. The last place you can possibly imagine would bring you happiness or resolution or comfort. And so when you tell people to sit still, they run the other way. And of course, running the other way is into conflict. It's into avoidance. It's into trying to find relief from the pressures and pains of all of the dynamics of change that are occurring around you. So getting people to get into stillness is all by itself one of the most challenging things there is. However, if you're listening to this conversation or dialogue, this talk, you've already kind of assumed that as a possibility. Something about you has said, this is a way to go, and probably most of you who are here have begun to find that it actually works, that it actually begins. Once you go under the surface of your noisy mind, something resides, and it's very, very calming. You have to be courageous enough to sit there in that dynamic activity until you just, through power of will or need or hunger or fear or whatever it is, to just let go, let go, let go, let go, let go, let go. And then suddenly there you are, at the center of all of this, but not touched by it. By going deep inside, by going into the inner workings of your own nature, you find you have a doorway to something that, in the simplest terms, loves you. It gave birth to you. It gave you life. It brought you into existence. We can argue why it did that. We can argue how it did that, what this is all about. Who knows? You know, this unknowability of knowing yourself and knowing others is also part of this thing of who knows how or why we even emerged. But the absolute truth, as best we can see it, is that we have emerged and that we do exist. And that we exist with all of this drama and stuff going on around us, with an enormous hunger for love, embrace, compassion, acceptance, recognition, acknowledgement. We all hunger for that, and we don't quite get it outside ourselves. Or we get it for 5 minutes or 5 years or whatever, and then the one person who acknowledged us dies or doesn't acknowledge us anymore. Then what? The change, the outer change that takes place over and over and over is so dynamic and so threatening to the stability of the self. On the other hand, if you can ride the current of that and sit still and be very, very at ease with yourself for a little bit, you will go below the surface and you will start to come to a place that is, at first, if nothing else, less turbulent than what's on the surface. And you can go deeper and deeper into that space, and you can find in it a kind of restfulness, a kind of being taken into the still point of your being, a kind of acknowledgement that you're okay. It's really interesting that that exists. And it's interesting that you can find your way to it. There are people who claim they are there all the time, that they are resting in that space all the time. You know, the great spiritual teachers will talk about this abiding awareness. And I think it may exist. I will say it is not my truth. And I tell you that as a way of, and I said this to you I think before, of disqualifying myself from the entire realm of spiritual teaching, because I have a propensity to be in the world and to be part of the world and to care deeply about how the world works and what happens in the world. And I worry about the world. I worry about my children and my grandchildren in the world. I worry about you guys in the world. And I go, well, then so much for my spiritual attainment and awareness, and probably you should discount everything I'm saying, because what do I know? I'm just like everybody else, of course, which to me is a truth, that we're all like each other. I keep trying to understand how an abiding person, deeply, deeply within themselves, responds to the fact that their grandchild is in danger of whatever is about to happen. It could be a hurricane that's coming, or a volcano that's exploding, or some horrible event that's happening in their life, and sitting back and abiding in a state of, oh well, or thy will be done. I get it. I think there are people who could do that. I'm not one of them. My first reaction would be grab my grandchild or my grandchildren, grab my children, my wife, try to take whatever I can and find a safe haven, knowing full well that no such thing exists. But my instinct, my absolute instinct, is to protect everyone I love, which happens to include you. And the only way I know to protect you, the only way I know, is to say, look, guys, look here, Y2K was happening back, 16 years ago. I had my entire New York class stay at my house overnight on New Year's Eve. That's what I did. I had food and water put aside. We had a bonfire the night before to throw all of our fears into the bonfire. It never lit. The bonfire, we couldn't get it to light. So not a good moment. But we all went to bed at midnight, and we woke up on the 1st of January, and we were still there, and we were happy. And I did not once for one second regret that I had had everybody come and stay with me. That is the nature that I have. It is, Blanche thinks of it as a worry wart, and I will acknowledge that it is. And I'm a dramatist. It's how I made my living. Honestly, if I didn't write dramatic movies, we wouldn't be sitting in this house and in this environment. But it's not the best thing in the world to be that. And I have definitely, those of you who've talked to me in recent months, been worried about the nature of our cultural climate and the world we're in right now. And that's a worry that comes up. But I have also an ability to sit still and dive deep and find that amazing place that is free of it all. Not free in the sense that it doesn't care, but free of investment in it in that moment. I actually can sit down and go, thy will be done. It's really an exquisite alternative. But I don't abide there. And I don't abide there because I'm still in a body, still part of the world and the manifested world around me, and I care deeply about that world. So, as a side to anybody who is looking for a different teacher, fine. I encourage you, find a teacher who abides. But I am a teacher who is working it out, as you are, with you along the way, trying to make this thing real and happen and figure out how to go day by day, because it's challenging. It's really challenging. But I will tell you, as our therapist told us, it's an inside job. It's just how it works. It's between you and yourself. It's between you and the deep what is within you. And if you don't have a path to that what is, you're going to be floundering around in a world that will never satisfy or take care of your situation, because the world isn't meant to do that. The world is an endless, unfolding drama. It's a continual, scandal, melodrama. Blanche loves scandal. She finally got me to watch two episodes of it. Oh my God, is it addictive? It's such an incredible show. But every minute of it is like, oh, the best thing happens, the worst thing happens. The best happens, the worst. It just keeps going and going and going. That's life, guys. That's what life is. It's like that, and then you're dead. And then you go, and this is really kind of important. Everybody wants a happy ending. You want, to live happily ever after, which of course doesn't happen. But you want an ending that adds up and makes sense. And I almost died of a heart thing a year ago. I realized it can end without any resolution, without any final words to everyone you love, without gathering around the bed and saying thank you to everybody. It can just end like that with meaninglessness, and it's over. It's over. So how do you live in this world of changeability that can change into this ultimate end of life moment and find peace, joy, meaning, value, all of those things in it? How do you do that? Well, the only answer I have is it's an inside job. Go deep. Go deep. Sit inside. Find the place that in a sense gives. Meaning is a big word, and I'm not even sure that's right, but it gives substance to the manifested unmanifest. It's a mystery. It's a mystery. It's the only thing I can ever say about any of this. It's a mystery. But it's a mystery that appears to be totally worth it. Why would we care otherwise? Why would we have all these emotions? Why would we be so involved and hopeful and rooting for so many outcomes if it didn't matter? Why? It's a great story. It's a great ride. It's a great thing to be alive. And in a certain sense, the abiding thing we're all looking for is something we already have, which is, wow, we're alive. That's the abiding thing. Being alive, period. You are here, period. That is amazing. And it's what we know. Now, will at the end, when the blackout happens, will we still be here? You know, there are people who say yes. And I sort of think so, that we'll still be a presence, if not this presence. But could be wrong. Does it matter? Not really. Not really. What matters is right now, this amazing thing of being is what matters. And how do you live in a world of being and feel harmonized and feel balanced and equilibrized, if that's a word? How do you find that? Balancing it by going deep, the inside job. Go into this place inside through the noise of your emotions, through the noise of your thoughts, through the noise of your assumptions, and just sit still. That's it. Balance. Unchangeable stillness. Are you supposed to live there? I mean, I did a 10-day meditation retreat some years ago, which I hated. And there were two women, I think they were like nuns. I don't know who they were, what they were. They didn't even get up for meals. I don't know what they did. I don't know if they eat or, I don't know if they ate or drank anything. They just sat there in the front row for 10 days. They must have gone to sleep. I didn't watch all of that. But they were completely in a still-pointedness. And on one level, I really admired that. On another level, I went, come on, have a life. Be part of this. Enjoy this. And I think that's what distinguishes part of what I'm teaching. It's like, this is not about permanent retreat. It's not about permanent abiding in a state of disconnection from the world. It's about being in a state of openness and availability to all of the above. That's what I teach here. Does that mean anything? Maybe. You can find any way you want to go. Like I say, we're all distinctively other. Those guys sitting in that front row, not moving at all, that was great. But I remember when Muktananda was teaching at Rudy's, and one of Muktananda's primary students at the time was sitting up on a platform next to near Muktananda, and when Muktananda and everybody else would leave and go eat and have brunch and come back, and this kid never moved. He just sat there. It was like for days, as I recall. And Rudy got really upset, and he ran onto the stage and started slapping this guy. He says, "Get out of it! Come out of it!" You know, Rudy going into a trance was not spiritual anything. It was just a trance. Yes, you can go into a trance, but what is that? And it was a really big moment. And I saw it happen, and I was like, it kind of woke me up, because I was moving toward trance state. Let me be in a trance. Get me out of here. Well, it's not about getting out of here. It's about getting to here and seeing what this is. It's a reflection of, in an amazing way, a formulated expression of a still point. Impossible to understand, impossible to grasp, with lots of people in you who are other and you will never understand either. But we're all in this amazing configuration of stuff without a clue, except for the fact that we have the same parent. We have the same source. We all return to the same singularity. And out of that, there is something common in us, a commonality that is phenomenally meaningful, that is beautiful and wonderful, I think. It feels like that to me, and worth knowing. If we can know ourselves in our root system, then we can appreciate ourselves in our bigger system, in our bigger manifested form. And that's kind of how it works. Love the other. And you'll do that if you love yourself. If you love yourself, you will love the other. If you don't love yourself, good luck. And the only way to love yourself is not as some outside formal thing, because you have lots of money and you're beautiful and you've got, you know, people love you and all. No, that doesn't mean anything. Love yourself And the self is really much deeper than the ego mind, than the personality, than the presentation. The self is the substantial core truth of what you are. Love it. Find it. Be it. I was walking down the street last week in Northridge, which is now called Sherwood Forest. I live in a place that's changed its name, but for me, it's impossible to remember to change the name, but it's now called Sherwood Forest. And I'm walking down the street in Sherwood Forest. And as I'm walking, I mean, I'm thinking like mad. I'm working on a TV show, one thing, and I am thinking about the world around us. And this guy is standing out in front of his gate on the street. I've never seen him before. He's just standing there, kind of an older guy. And he looks at me and he said, "You don't have to think so much." And then he said, "It's already happened." And I just went, poof. It was like that. And I looked at him because I didn't know, who is this guy? And why is he saying this to me? And he said, "Where are you from?" I said, "Detroit." He said, "Oh, we got a lot of Armenians there." And I said, "Well, I gather you're Armenian." He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, thank you for what you said." And I smiled, and he smiled, and I just kept walking. And I suddenly thought God had broken through the unformed space and yelled at me in the world and told me some phenomenal truth. Why it passed through this man's lips, I have no idea. Why it came to me at that moment out of such a profound, extraordinarily blast of clarity. But it was a beautiful statement. You don't have to worry so much. It's already happened. Or you don't have to think so much. There is a real truth to that. In the singularity of existence, past, present, future are one thing. Somebody once said, "The last time I looked, God was still in his heaven." Trust the world. Trust the world. I think that's the lesson we have to keep coming to. And things are going to challenge that, and some are going to challenge it in a big way, and I completely cop to the truth that I get challenged, you know, by caring a lot. On the other hand, I do know it's already happened. Just sit back. You always have this extraordinary place of love, harmony, embrace, equilibrium, solidity, stability within you, and you can always go there no matter what. It's always yours. And that's something we all have, we all share, and we all are part of. So it's my last comment to you. It's an inside job. Thank you. Any comments? Okay.
Well, I have.
Go for it.
So, just because you often talk about your awakening, and now you've talked about this abiding place, and I imagine the abiding place was there before the awakening. You reached that abiding place in your meditations before the awakening. Anyway, I'm just curious about contrasting the abiding place and the awakening. Are they the same? Are they,
you know, I mean, different? There are a lot of people you could talk to. I had lunch last week with a guy named Jeff Foster, who's a really wonderful non-dualist who has a huge, huge following that I totally respect. And I love this guy, and I love that we got to have a lunch, and it was a great lunch. And one of the things we both came to is we don't understand what abiding is. That we don't get it. We don't know who abides, and if they do, well, wonderful. But neither of us have met anybody who abides really. Although we may have, you know, I also had a meeting with Eckhart Tolle a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and he may be an abider. I mean, he just feels like he may have that, but it's a. Whatever it is, it's not an attainment. Abiding is an awareness. It's an awareness. And some people settle into it. I have to say, when my own awakening took place, I thought, I'm abiding. I've arrived. I'm there. That was a big deal for me. I'm there. And I thought, wow, this is great. And then I started having these little things that I've described to you all before, and that Paul Hederman described in me as brucing. Little bruises would come up in the middle of abiding, and they would kind of wash away some of the abiding. And I thought, well, what was this? Was this real? Was this false? Did I awaken? Did I not awaken? And yet the bruising would keep falling away, and the awakening would still be there. And then you start to realize, because one for one thing, the awakened state is not a singular thing. It is a, for me, for better or for worse, it's an expanding, flowering experience. It keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger in ways that are hard to describe. It contains Bruce. That's the thing. You don't get rid of this until it's gone, until you're dead. So it's still there. Sometimes it goes, wah, it makes a lot of noise, and sometimes it goes quietly. But does that mean I'm not abiding? Because Bruce has suddenly appeared and said, I'm worried about the culture, I'm worried about people, I'm worried about what's happening around me. Does that deny the abiding thing? Well, if you want to make that an interpretation, then go, yeah. Then say yes. But it keeps coming back. It comes back over and over and over. It comes back when I take a breath. It comes back when I sit here and teach. It comes back when I go for walks. It's like, ah. And then there are times I'm walking, like when this guy saw me, and I'm going, how do I solve the problem of this show, and how do I solve the problem of the world? They're both kind of simultaneous. And that's the world of doing. The world of doing inserts itself regularly into the world of being. The world of being is a constant. The world of doing is occasional. And a lot of people only get to the world of being when they're doing. If you're doing something, and you're totally into it, there's no you doing. It's just, it's happening. And the not doing is really a taste of the abiding. But the abiding is there as long as you're alive, as long as you're breathing, as long as you're sitting here, you are abiding. There's just no awareness of abiding. So really, awakening is like a bigger awareness. It's like, oh, this being is bigger than the doing. This being is a presence that is constantly there. And it's the old idea of the fish swimming in the water saying, what's this thing called water? It's there. It's just there all the time. We are always in it. We're always of it. It doesn't go away. And it's awareness of it or not awareness of it. But if this fish swam through the water going, water, this is 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 water, what a crazy fish that would be. You know? And if we swam around in this world and went, oh, this is present, I'm present, I'm present, I'm present, that's not how it works. You just are. You just are. You're breathing the air. You are being. The being is such an unbelievable rootedness of existence that's what you are. It's really who you are. To walk around aware of it separates you from it. It cuts you, it makes you two. And when being, which is what you do very naturally, is really an awareness that is constant. On the other hand, awakening creates, in the simplest sense, a kind of a light on in the room as opposed to a light off. It's a kind of like, oh. You're just aware of being, as not consciously, not thinking about it. You're alive to it, as opposed to asleep in it. Does that make sense? I mean, asleep in it means go through the day, and then you wake and you go, oh. You're still going through the day. It's the same thing, just as before, except now you know. And before you were just, excuse me, just kind of figuring it out as you're kind of blindly going through your existence. That's the difference. It's aware of it, not aware of it. Does it change anything? Not really. Not really, except for the fact that you can be grateful. Which is, for me, I keep saying, the big things that have come to me through awakening have been gratitude and this sense of the mystery, of the true mystery of being, which is an extraordinary thing to be aware of, as opposed to going, oh, this is just another day, I'm getting up. That's a horrible way to live. To walk, to get up and go, another one. Whew. And totally unknown what's going to happen. You know, and I watch it, so much is going on around me. My kids are having these lives that are changing very dramatically right now. And both of them suddenly took huge changes for the better. And it was like, oh, this is wonderful. For weeks, it was like, oh, the bottom dropped out. You know, what's going to happen to my poor kids? You know, losing jobs, things, all these horrible things. Now all this great stuff is appearing. And it's like, okay, this is how it works. It goes down and it goes up. And it goes down and it goes up. And for all of us, that's what it does all the time. Abiding means I get it. Abiding means not totally investing in one or the other. So when my kids' life started going down, I went, oh, oh. But I didn't go into a state of total depression. I just said, I'm here, I can help you, I love you, I support you, da da da. When it went up, I was totally delighted, but I have a complete understanding that it's got the opportunity and will soon probably go down again. That's abiding awareness. That life is change. Life is changeable. It constantly is altering. And that's the truth. And that's what Buddha taught us. You know, it's endless change. And so, once you accept that, and you don't try to buy into getting to the better place and avoiding the lesser place, you start to live differently. You start to see this is a ride. It's a ride. And in that ride are these exquisitely beautiful moments that you might have missed if you weren't aware of it. You know, I am in love with my grandchildren. You've heard me say that. I know people who are not in love with their grandchildren, who are disturbed by having to deal with their grandchildren. I go, okay, I'm going to take the ride that is in love, which means I also suffer when they get hurt. You know, I cry with them. I don't cry as much as they do, you know. I mean, I can kiss the wounds and do all that stuff, but I am on the ride with them. I'm also, when it's necessary, capable of taking a breath and going, thy will be done. But that doesn't mean I can't get caught in the hopes and dramas and ambitions of what I would call growth and transformation for humanity. And I do. I get caught up in it. That's my limitation.
I remember you talking at the retreat about, you know, a minute from now, you know, a few days from now, you get caught up in the same stuff. And I find myself driving over here and realizing that I kind of have. And it reminds me that you talked about also having that overwhelming desire to make this, you know, maybe the most important or the most important thing in life. I don't think I started out that way when I was meditating. It was just a thought when somebody offered me the opportunity, a thought that a lot of my troubles arise in the mind and that I could come here and get better. And I still don't think I have, I think it's a much bigger kind of place, but I forget. I forget I'm an old pothead or it's just a light, you know, human existence. I forget about this and other things become, you know, more important. Even sitting down and breathing, other things I'm thinking about become more important. So the question is it important to cultivate and that memory or just be present and it'll come? You know, the overwhelming desire to?
I'll tell you the way I get it, okay? I mean, first of all, Rudy told me it's a life's work and that you have to do this for the rest of your life. And I said, fine. And I practiced, I sat every day until the awakening took place, in which time I didn't feel I needed to sit because sitting was about getting somewhere or deepening something. And when the awakening took place, there was nowhere else for me particularly to want to go or need to go. So there was a kind of the life's work kept working. I kept working and working, and I think you've heard this story a few thousand times. I got to the point where I said, this work isn't getting me anywhere. And I gave up. I stopped meditating. 2 weeks later, this awakening took place. And the awakening took place when I stopped trying. On the other hand, the trying was crucial. It was part of what defined me, and it's what kept me in the game for almost 50 years of reaching and reaching and reaching, and then say, I can't get there, and then realize, you're there. You've always been there. And that's kind of what I would say to you. The trying is really essential on some level, but it's getting to a place of what I would call consistency, if you can do that. A place where you really start to establish yourself as someone who does this work, who practices this thing. Because if you're an occasional meditator or an occasional, let me be more specific, an occasional gym rat. If you go to the gym for 2 solid weeks and you work yourself out and then you pull a muscle, you know, and then you don't go to the gym for a month or two. Then you decide to go again and the muscle's repaired itself and you really work out and something else happens. You don't end up, there's no development. You won't have anything to show for all that time and effort. The time and effort of sitting still produces a person who can sit still, produces a person who can, when they have to, come to their own center, draw inward, and find themselves opening to themselves. And they can do it because the muscle's working. If you do it occasionally, it's not going to work so readily. better to do it occasionally than not to do it at all, perhaps, you know, but to do it regularly, to be persistent and consistent, produces real results. And Rudy used to always say, what do you want besides results? So I've had a life pre-awakening that resembles everything in awakening, because it was a life of conscious effort. It was a life working towards something bigger and something greater, and also something deeper and more wonderful, more loving, more whole, more absolute in itself. That was great. And so I'm completely content that I made all that effort over all that time, and the awakening, not that it was a result of it, it's hard to put it that way, but it kind of is what, it's like being healthy from having been in the gym for 40 years. You're healthy. That's the awakening. You're like, oh, I'm healthy. And you start looking at people around you who didn't go to the gym for 40 years, and they're not healthy. They're dealing with, you know, their emphysema and all of these different issues. I have a lot of friends with all these huge issues that come out of not having done anything inside. And you go, okay. And you know it's getting late in the game. Of course, you can always start. You can always start. You can always make yourself healthier. You can always stop smoking. You can always work out. You can always go for walks and make yourself a healthier human being. And it's a great thing. You can make yourself a deeper, more meditative, stabilized human being by going inside and seeing what's there. It's very valuable. So don't give up on this. You know, don't even if it's erratic, it's happening. And I, as a teacher, if you want to call me that, looks at you and sees transformation. I do. I see it when I talk to you. I see it looking at you. I see it working with you. Something is happening. Can it be more deeper? Well, if I was Rudy, I would say absolutely. As Bruce, I just go, I love you. Do what you can do. The universe is working. And if you want to engage the universe, if you want to be a partner in the universal forms and forces that are at work, then do this. Be part of it. Say yes to it. Don't fight life. Give yourself over to it. Or in the simplest way, be open-hearted. Be open to the world. Be open to others. Be open to yourself. Be open to the journey. And then find the thing that says this is what you should do. What do you do with this open-heartedness? It usually has to do with caring for others and caring for yourself. That's kind of what comes out of being open-hearted. It's an empathy for others, and it's an empathy for yourself. It will help you begin something. It can be meditation, gym, eating different, you know, whatever that thing is. There's something in us that knows we can treat ourselves better and treat the world better. And that's wonderful. Something we do that comes out of being open. Does that help?
It helps tremendously. I mean, the question was how to find the inner desire, the deeper inner desire, and you talked about being open-hearted and finding that place. I have enough desire to do this regularly, but the last few months I haven't sat down because, maybe partly because there's more energy, I'm doing more stuff, and that's kind of my MO. I get all too much dispersed and I don't actually sit down and make time, you know, find the time to do it every day.
Well, here's what the universe will do. When you get sloppy, it will slap you in the head. It will. When you get sloppy with your work, something will happen. You know, it could be any number of things, you know, but you'll be aware of it. And then you'll have a choice. Do I go back and become conscious again, or do I stay sloppy in my life? Sloppy lives have sloppy results. Conscious lives have conscious results. That's all I know. Not that sloppy and difficult things might happen, but you will be more responsive to that just because you're conscious. The unconscious life is unbelievably chaotic, creates enormous karmic consequence for people that goes on for years, decades, and lifetimes. And the conscious life stills that down and makes you much more of a contributor to the life process. You know, you can contribute to life just by being blah, 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 and stuff happens, and you see that all over the place. You know, watch what do they call it, television, you know, this, I don't know what those shows are called, Survivor, reality. Watch reality shows and see what people are doing. You know, watch what people are living, and you go, most people watch those to laugh at them, but most people are not much different. Sloppy lives have sloppy results, and they create awfulness in a life. And that awfulness perpetuates more awfulness in other people's lives, and it goes on and on and on. It's called karma, consequence. And if you don't turn that around, it's going to be like that. How do you get to turn it around? Well, either you become aware that your life is shit and you've got to do something, or you get really slammed up against it, you know, literally, figuratively, car accidents, you know, something terrible happens and that wakes you up, or you can make a choice. And the choice is, I'm going to get myself and my act together. I'm going to sit quietly and I'm going to open. And you will see the results of it, but they're subtle a lot of the time. Subtle meaning well-being as opposed to chaotic, stressful being. But that well-being is wonderful. But a lot of people get into well-being and they go, oh, I feel great. Now I'm going to eat a gallon of ice cream because I feel good. You know, or they do the opposite. They're in a terrible state and they eat a gallon of ice cream. The thing is, get to a state of well-being and go, I don't need anything other than this. This is it. This is beautiful. This is wonderful. That's all I can tell you. That's how it works. And if you do it, life unfolds in the way that it wants to unfold rather than in a chaotic state that it often does unfold. And in a way, it almost is like it doesn't care which choice you make, which is kind of interesting. But I would, if I were you, care. That's why I say when you open your heart to yourself, you care and you achieve a change or a transformative state. If you don't care, good luck. If you want to see what not caring looks like, basically look around you. I mean, this is an unusual group of people because we've gathered here together because everyone in this room, to some degree, cares. That's the distinguishing factor, care for yourself. When you get to that point and it starts to have muscular aspect, you will stay alert to possibility and you will, Rudy called grow, but really you will expand and encompass and embrace and find unbelievable fulfillment in your day-to-day experience. And that's a great thing.
So when I was kind of thinking what to ask, that the question I asked was very important, but I think one is kind of like what I really want to ask is, will I be okay through life and through passing?
Will you? Mm-hmm. You have a lot to do with that, to be honest. But the mere fact that you have that question, the mere fact that you sit here and ask that with such openness and with such caring for yourself, my answer would be yes. But not by wishing it and dreaming it, by doing the work. Rudy called this the work. The work is be conscious, be open, be available, sit still, go deep, as opposed to just have a good time, goodbye. Because nobody has a good time, period. Nobody. Nobody. It's not a good time out there. It's struggle. It's a lot of work. So you can do the work of going deep and opening, or you can do the work of just trying to be happy out in the world, which is fraught with difficulties because nothing is constant in the world. You cannot maintain happiness in the world except internally. Okay. Enough. I love you guys. Thank you. Thank you for coming and honored.